Vous avez 40 minutes.
Merci. Okay. Merci. Malheureusement, mon français, ce n'est pas assez bien de présenter en français. Je suis désolé. But as an American, I have more important things to be embarrassed about, like Donald Trump. But I assure you that he will not be the president, okay? So I'm going to talk a little bit. My talk will be somewhat similar to Nicholas, because we're talking about fast reactors here, but this is about the integral fast reactor, which has some very different characteristics. I started this with a book that I wrote and published in 2008. The URL on top, you can download the book for free if you'd like, and it talks a lot about the integral fast reactor. And these slides will be available if you want them. After I wrote the book, the two people who were my main tutors, I'm not a nuclear physicist or an engineer. I was a commercial fisherman, actually, for 20 years. When the people who were directing the project at Argonne National Laboratories found out I was going to write a book about this, they wanted to make sure that it would be absolutely accurate. So they tutored me in reactor design and reactor engineering and physics for about 9 years. And after my book came out, a couple years later, they decided, yeah, we should write a book too. So they wrote this book that tells the story about how this reactor was developed. And you can also download that book for free at that URL on the top. Okay. What happened was I had found out about the integral fast reactor when I was writing a novel, and when I realized that this fantastic technology existed that could essentially power the whole planet with fuel that we've already got out of the ground for thousands of years, I decided to write the book. And after I wrote it, I got a telephone call, and I was asked to send the book to a person in Russia who I didn't know, but it turns out it was Evgeny Velikov, who was the top scientist in Russia, pretty much ran their national laboratories. And he's the one who had started the ITER project. And when he realized the extent that the United States had developed the fast reactor, he realized that he would not live to see fusion providing energy for humanity, but he realized that the fast reactors could. So he decided that he would put a conference together, and they decided to start a think tank. And they asked me to run the think tank, so that's what I do. And this is our think tank. Now, one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book was because of global warming, which in the United States, you know, a lot of people don't believe in it, but we have proof. You know. And like many graphs, you know, sometimes the data gets so small that you can't see it anymore, so I had to stop at 1990. Now, there's a lot of experience with fast reactors around the world, over 350 reactor years of experience. These are the ones, most of them, you've already probably heard of. And in the beginning, when the first electricity that was produced from nuclear power was produced from a fast reactor, the EBR-1, and the scientists at that time thought uranium was very rare and that fast reactors would just be the way that everybody would do this in the future. But light water reactors ended up being developed for the submarines, and then they just scaled them up. So the utilization of uranium is very poor, and you have to store the waste for hundreds of thousands of years, Whereas with excuse me, with the integral fast reactor and pyroprocessing, the disposal time is about 300 years, and so and it's in a form that's ceramic or metal or glass that won't leach into the environment until long after the radioactivity has reduced to below the level of natural uranium. I'm not going to go through every bit of these, but I'll, like I say, I'll make the slides available. I can email them to you or whatever, if you wish. So basically, this is the long and the short of it. You to run a 1 gigawatt fast reactor, you bring in 1 ton of depleted uranium every year, and that's about 2 milk crates full. So and depleted uranium, it's safe enough you could carry it in. Except you can't carry a milk crate full of uranium because it's a half a ton. You have to do it with a forklift or something. But you don't end up with plutonium, with separated plutonium anywhere. And you don't ever have to enrich uranium anymore. So the Integral Fast Reactor Project started at what's now called Idaho National Laboratory. It was Argonne National Laboratory West. And they built this reactor in 1964. They fired it up, and they ran it for 30 years. This is a diagram similar to what Nicholas had. It basically shows the simplicity of a pool-type system, which operates at atmospheric pressure and is in a separate structure from the water side of the heat exchanger, so you don't have a problem with water-sodium interaction. Now, when Charles Till decided that he was going to try to solve all the problems associated with nuclear power, he really wanted to use metal for fuel instead of oxide for a number of reasons, safety reasons and economic reasons, and the practicality. The problem was that when metal fuel is fissioning, it swells up about 40%. And so when they first started to try it, they would just get maybe 1% burn up and then the cladding would break. And when he decided that he was going to try to go back and look at this, the fast reactor project at Dounreay in the UK, the people had been, they'd been trying to figure out how to use metal for a long time. And they said, don't bother, you know, we've tried it. You're never going to get it to work. You can't get enough burn up. It's going to break your cladding. And so he decided he was going to still try it. So actually one day they were sitting around in the office trying to figure out, you know, how can we do this? And somebody said, well, you know, we've got sodium on the outside. We're using sodium because it transfers heat extremely efficiently. So why don't we just make the fuel pins 40% smaller and put sodium inside the cladding? And that way the heat will be transferred from the fuel pin. And as it swells up, it'll transfer the heat. So you don't have to machine it like you do with fuel pellets, with oxide fuel pellets, where you machine these pellets down to like within microns. This way you could just put in a fuel pellet, say 4 inches, plus or minus 2 inches. It's like extremely simple because it's got all kinds of space in there. And that's an example of one of these breakthroughs that seems so obvious in retrospect. But people had worked on it for years and years and tried to figure this out. So they put the small fuel pins in, they filled it with sodium there, and in the top, there's a gas plenum where the fission gases will collect. And so what happens is the swelling in the fuel is caused by bubbles made by fission gases, and so the bubbles start to leak out into the... what happens is, as it swells up, the sodium that's around the thing is forced up into the plenum. And so the fuel rod is getting larger and larger and larger and coming closer and closer to the outside of the cladding. And after a while, that those little holes, those little bubbles, they start to join and form channels, and then the channels liberate the gas from the fuel pin, and the gas then goes up into the plenum, and the sodium that was forced into the plenum comes down and goes into the holes. So essentially you get extremely efficient heat transfer through the entire process, and it works great. And they did it for a long time. So they built this reactor, and what they wanted to do was to build an integral recycling area. So they just transfer the fuel bundles over to here, and it's a hot cell because it's highly radioactive, and they do the recycling in the associated building. Now, the idea is to build power plants with several reactors and a single recycling plant and never move plutonium. The plutonium is never separated with the pyroprocessing. The plutonium is always mixed with other actinides. But the only time you would ever move the plutonium or the fuel that contains a mix of actinides off the reactor site is if you're starting up another reactor. If you configure the fuel for maximum breeding with the metal fuel, you can get a doubling time of just 7 years. So Hervé's, the paper that we worked on together, talks about a doubling time of, 15 or 20 years, I think. But if you use metal fuel, you can actually greatly reduce the doubling time. So they recycled over 30,000 fuel pins using this technology. So, I've heard many people say that, well, we don't know how to do this, but we absolutely know how to do this. And when the project was shut down in 1994, it was in its very last stage. The next step was to design a commercial scale recycling plant to recycle this fuel. But at the time, the U.S. was going to put all their spent fuel from their light water reactors into Yucca Mountain. And so the Department of Energy told the people at Argonne, don't design this to recycle oxide fuel, just metal fuel. And so that was the constraints they were working under. And then they shut down the project for political reasons, and they buried it. And the Department of Energy even suppressed the information until I wrote my book, actually. So what you're looking at it with the used fuel is a very small amount of plutonium, 1% plutonium, 5% fission products that you want to get rid of. And that's your real waste, but it's not radioactive for that long. So the idea was to design a recycling plant that could handle 100 tons per year. And if you do that, you get 5 tons of fission products that you just have to, I keep hitting the wrong button here, that you just have to store for 300 years, and you can bury it virtually anywhere because, like I say, it won't leach anything into the environment. And you get 2 tons of fuel, and you get 93 tons of depleted uranium, which is easy to store, and we have plenty of it. So about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, we had a meeting with the Secretary of Energy and proposed that we design this, basically take up where the project left off in 1994, restart the project and design a 100 ton per year recycling facility. And the Department of Energy agreed to do that. And so the first 2 years of the project, we did the conceptual design, and now they're doing the final design, which will be finished next year. And then we'll be ready to build this. And it's very, very simple. compared to aqueous reprocessing, which, you know, I'm sure many of you, probably most of you, have been to La Hague and you've seen the huge recycling facility. It looks like a city, but two-thirds of it is underground. This thing, you can put this in almost in a large garage. It's not very big at all. And it'll be quite cheap. But what's really important about, one of the important things about this is it essentially solves the million-year waste problem. Now, those of you who are engineers or scientists or who study these things understand that nuclear waste is really not a problem even the way it is today. There's so little of it. It's easy to store. But it's a public perception problem. So if you want nuclear power to be powering the world, a big part of making the public aware that this isn't a problem is finding a way to solve it. And so this is a logarithmic scale that's about 300 years. By the time you get to the level of natural uranium ore, if you recycle it using pyroprocessing. Now, unlike the safety factor of getting your radiation down for the waste, when it comes to the fuel, you want the radiation to be really high because you don't want people stealing it and making it into weapons. So this gives you some idea of the actinide mix that you have for pyroprocessing IFR fuel. You have extremely high radiation, so it has to be, the whole process has to be done in hot cells, and there's no danger of somebody stealing it, taking it out, building a weapon. You can't build a weapon with something that has this much gamma radiation and other types of radiation that is going to make it impossible to even handle. Now, at the time that this slide was made, it was before we did our project, our conceptual design project for the 100-ton per year facility, and they came up with a number of 400 million. And actually, once they costed it all out in 2015 dollars, that was almost exactly what they came out with. They came out with anywhere from 375 to 450 million dollars. And that's for the first one. Now, if you design this and then you want to build recycling plants to recycle large amounts, you would build essentially cookie-cutter operations because you have the issue of criticality. So you can only do certain size batches, but you can have certain economies of scale by building several of these in the same place. So the cost for the recycling is very minor when it comes to building a recycling center on site where you have the power plant. So in the final years of the IFR project, General Electric put together a consortium of American companies, including Westinghouse and Bechtel, Raytheon, Babcock and Wilcox, and they went up to Idaho National Lab, and they worked with the engineers and scientists there, and they developed the PRISM reactor. And then General Electric has since had a small team of engineers refining the PRISM design for since the mid-90s. I call it the best reactor that's never been built. It's got 20 years of engineering work on it since they developed it there. And a lot of times people will say, well, you know, faster, it sounds great, but can you do it fast enough? You know, climate change isn't waiting for us, so what makes you think you can do this fast enough? Well, we saw France do it, go to from 20 to 80% nuclear in 11 years. At the same time, France's electricity demand was rising. It was doubling, so you actually went from 10% to 80% in 11 years. And that was with high-pressure reactors where you had to build pressure vessels and all that sort of thing. The PRISM is designed for mass production at atmospheric pressure, so you could definitely do it at least that fast. And I want to thank you in France for showing what can be done. So I spoke with over the years with the engineers who developed the PRISM reactor, and I've asked them, how complex is it to build a PRISM? If you had a factory to mass produce PRISM reactors, how complex would it be compared to building, say, a heavy bomber in World War II? And they always say it's much easier. Well, in 1945, the U.S. built 6,700 heavy bombers in 1 year in one country. And if you built 6,700 PRISM reactors, you would be able to produce as much electricity as the entire world produced in 2009 from all sources. So the idea that you can't build them fast enough is absolutely not true. The bottleneck is the startup fuel. You need fuel to start them. And that's the limitation. So you would want to be building more enrichment plants. If you were going to build these very quickly, you'd want to build more enrichment plants and do it as fast as possible and configure them for maximum breeding so that you could have a 7-year doubling time. As far as fuel availability is concerned, it's really not a problem. The U.S. has probably 800,000 tons of depleted uranium. Russia has almost 1 million tons. France, I believe, has sent a lot of their depleted uranium to Russia. I heard that because I was at a conference in St. Petersburg, and there was an environmentalist there complaining that Russia was taking depleted uranium from France and that was a bad idea. And I said, well, that's a great idea for Russia. It's fuel, you know. But in reality, there's so much of this around the world that we'll never use it all. Even if we build fast reactors to power the whole planet, long before this is all used up, we'll be running with dilithium crystals or something else. And, you know, we just aren't going to need it. But suffice it to say that there's so much fuel available that you will never have to mine uranium again. There's some more of it. We have several locations like this around the United States, and I'm sure that there are many like this in Russia as well, and in the UK. The UK has enough depleted uranium to power its country for at least 500 years. I don't know what that is. Whoa, I'm done. That was really fast. Okay. So would there be any questions or comments or anything like that? This is a little shorter than I thought. Usually I have trouble getting it in an hour, but normally I talk about other technologies besides this. So, I wanted to talk a little bit about the cost of this. General Electric has estimated, they were asked to testify before the Congress about how much these would cost, and the number they came up with was about $2,000 a kilowatt in 2015 dollars. Now, I know that a lot of times companies will say that something is, you know, they'll give an estimate of a price, and it will be wildly below what it actually turns out to be. This has happened in the United States, actually, with Areva, which assured the United States that if they built a MOX plant for us at Savannah River to dispose of our weapons-grade plutonium, it would cost $550 million. And it's not finished yet, and the price is about $7 billion and still counting. So you can take cost estimates with a grain of salt, but General Electric has a pretty good record recently in this regard because they built the Advanced Boiling Water Reactor. That's the last of the newer design reactors that they built. And they built them in Japan, the first two, Hitachi and Toshiba, each built one. And it took 36 and 39 months to build the first of a kind reactors, and they cost around $2,000, actually a little bit less than $2,000 a kilowatt. So I believe that their cost estimate is quite credible. They want to build them in the UK because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States is kind of broken, I would say. When nuclear reactors were first being developed, the engineers and physicists would build the test reactors and they would try them out. And then after they tested them and figured out the design, they would then apply for licensing, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would license them. Now the system has been turned upside down. So if you want to build a new reactor, you have to get a license for it before you can build it. And so you can't test it. We're in a situation where companies have a real hard time starting anything new, even to design an evolutionary step of a current reactor, like General Electric recently did with the ESBWR. It's a generation 3+ light water reactor, and it cost them $1 billion to get it licensed. It took many years, I think almost a decade. And here they're talking about, I'm out of juice. Thank you. Okay. Here they're talking about trying to license an entirely new type of reactor, and the staff at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission doesn't even have the knowledge to do it. So General Electric hasn't even bothered to apply for a license. But then the UK came up with a problem with plutonium. The UK has the world's largest stockpile of plutonium, about 120 tons, and they want to get rid of it. And so the General Electric made a proposal to the UK to build PRISM reactors. France also, Areva made a proposal to build a MOX plant. Part of the problem with this UK plutonium is a lot of it is old and a lot of it is contaminated. About 25% of it is contaminated with chlorides or iron, and that's very untenable for a MOX system. But the pyroprocessing system is extremely forgiving. You could recycle all of that quite easily. So GE did a proposal for the UK. And thank you. All right. And the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority didn't want to hear about it. They said, you put your proposal in after the deadline. Actually, I had also put in a proposal for a similar thing. And I know it wasn't after the deadline. But what happened was there were a lot of people on the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority that didn't really want to talk about fast reactors. But fortunately, the chief scientist on the Department of Energy and Climate Change in the UK happened to be a friend of mine, and so he helped me get a fair hearing for General Electric, and they were invited to come over to the UK and make a proposal. And the process started then. That was about 3 years ago. And at this point, it looks like the PRISM is probably either the top contender or one of the two top contenders for the solution to the plutonium problem in the UK. Everything's been kind of slowed down because of Brexit and because of the controversy over Hinkley Point. So we've just been waiting and waiting. But now Hinkley Point, just this week, I think, or last week, was finally approved by the new government. So hopefully the UK will get going with some of their other projects and will make a decision regarding the PRISM reactor. As far as the time to build it, I was looking at Nicholas's presentation about how soon we can expect to see fast reactors that recycle everything, that recycle all the actinides. And it looked like 2040 and after that. Nicholas is younger than I am, so he's not as anxious, I think. I like to do things a little faster. And we are going to be ready to actually build the recycling plant within a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. Because, like I say, the design is already done, and the final design is just being finished. As far as building the PRISM reactors to burn the fuel that you would get with the recycling, General Electric, the engineers there who are in charge of the project, tell me that they could build it in about 3 years. So even if they're wrong by a factor of 100%, still it's a lot faster than 2040. So we should be able to do this. Any questions, comments?
Thank you, Tom, for the explanation. So this sounds such a good project. How come it doesn't get any amount of traction? Traction, public traction? How is the public reacting to
The public didn't know about it because the Department of Energy essentially suppressed it. In 1994, the U.S. stopped its fast reactor project, and the U.K. stopped their fast reactor project, both in the same year. And I always thought that was a strange coincidence. Because they were independent projects. Part of it was political because Bill Clinton's electoral base had a lot of environmentalists, and Al Gore had been making a lot of promises. And Al Gore actually is one of the reasons why climate change has become so politicized because, obviously as a vice president and presidential candidate, as soon as he came and said, climate change is a big deal, then all the Republicans say, no, we don't believe in it. Trump says it's a Chinese plot to destroy our economy. But it's almost a religious matter for the hyper-partisan U.S. Congress. If you're a Republican, you can't believe in climate change. What I found out later was that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was due to be renewed in 1994. And the countries that had nuclear weapons, which included, of course, the UK and the US, were supposed to demonstrate some level of reduction in nuclear weapons or proliferation resistance. And a cheap, easy way to do that was to just stop your fast reactor project, because so many people considered fast reactors to be a proliferation risk. And that's an argument that we could go on for quite a while. But suffice it to say that any time you have nuclear fission, you're going to have the potential for proliferation, no matter what. And it's not so much a technical issue as a political issue that has to be solved by international cooperation. But I think if the public had known about it, it would have gotten a lot more popular, because after my book came out, it got a lot more popular because people started finding out about it. And then Robert Stone made the movie Pandora's Promise. I don't know if any of you have seen Pandora's Promise, but it's... Yeah, okay, everybody's seen it. Yeah, it's on YouTube anyway.
So we won't have a projection.
Yeah, okay. Okay. So, yeah. Hear me?
Did you talk with the, Nicolas said... things are going to happen in Asia. Did you try, General Electric try to sell its whiskey to China or South Korea or India? they might be very interested.
Well, India was a problem because they had not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, so the United States was not cooperating with them in nuclear development at all. And actually, I talked with Ravi Grover, who was one of the people that did our paper, back in 2009, and I said, you know, that we were talking about their fast reactor in India, and I said, are you going to use metal fuel? And he said, well, no, we have an R&D program for metal fuel. And I said, well, you know, why don't you use the information that the U.S. has? He said, well, we had to figure this out by ourselves, you know. Since then, Ravi was actually instrumental in negotiating nuclear technology transfer agreements with the United States. So India and the U.S. are now working more closely on that. And they do plan to convert their fast reactors to metal fuel, as does Russia, actually. Sergei Kiryenko, right after Fukushima, came to Washington and he said, you know, we really want to develop our metal fuel and our fast reactors. Now, you know, the BN-800 fast reactor just came online in December, and it's now fully operational. And that's using oxide fuel. But but the Russians have advanced their timeline for selling BN-800s from 2030 to 2020. So they're planning, they've already sold two of them to China. China's going to build two. But they're planning to make the fast reactors one of their products that they're going to sell more widely. And they plan to ultimately end up using metal fuel. Now, one of the things I've been working on a lot for the last several years is trying to convince the United States to share all the data that we have on metal fuel, because we ran it for a long time. And, you know, it would be a really good thing. Now, South Korea has been involved with the fast reactor project in the U.S. for quite a while, and they're in the midst of an R&D project at Argonne National Laboratories that pretty much is in sync with the recycling project there. The South Koreans have actually already built a pyroprocessing plant. They just haven't turned it on because they have treaty agreements with the United States, and the United States has been suppressing it. So what happened was, and the suppression is because of concern about the spread of nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula, which is a horse that's already out of the barn in North Korea, and the South Koreans are perfectly willing to not build nuclear weapons. But essentially, the U.S. has slow-walked the project. The Koreans want to start pyroprocessing and building fast reactors right now. But the U.S. convinced them to do a 10-year R&D project for metal fuel at Argonne Labs, and I think it's probably in year five now. So within 5 years, Korea will start building these, if the U.S. doesn't do it first in the U.K. or in the U.S. As far as I know, China hasn't expressed an interest in it, but until I brought their fast reactor scientist to Idaho National Laboratory about 2 or 3 years ago, and they saw the pyroprocessing facilities, and they talked with the people that are doing the pyroprocessing. And as we left, they said, where can we buy one of these things? And I said, you don't want to buy one of these things, because this is a small one. You want to buy the commercial scale one, which we'll have ready in a few years. So China's definitely interested. Their fast reactor scientists are definitely interested. But like many countries, you have a number of different nuclear projects. You've got the fast reactor guys, you've got the molten salt guys, and you've got the light water reactor guys that have all the money and most of the power. So it's like little clubs, you know, here and there. And it's difficult for the fast reactor people in China to get traction. But ultimately, I think metal fuel is going to be used widely around the world because it's so incredibly easy to do. So easy to fabricate. It's extremely cheap. And you know, you can make it with abundant, virtually free fuel.
And thanks for a very interesting presentation. Two questions, actually. First one is, who did you work with? Who did the design of the reprocessing plant? And secondly, I hadn't seen the, you mentioned sodium in between the pellets and the fuel cladding. Did you say that was from Junrei? Is GE Prism looking at that? And does Nicola know about that? Have you looked at that? I don't know. Le sodium, on peut le tester et le crayon. Est-ce que vous regardez dans le CO?
Yeah, the person who's directing the project at Argonne National Laboratory for this commercial scale plant is Yun Chang. He was the manager of the IFR project, and he was actually retired when I found the money to put him back to work, and so he very quickly came back to work. This is his legacy project. He's about 70 years old now, 71, I think, and very active. And doing a really good job, the sodium inside the cladding thing that was developed in around 1990 thereabouts. I don't know the exact year, but that was the key to being able to use metal fuel.
Two short questions. All this seems so miraculous that one is led to ask you the question. Where are the problems? First question. Second question, is your message, to make sure I understand correctly, is your message to Nicolas that he should stop working on Astrid?
Actually, I tried to convince Anne Lauvergeon back in 2009, I think, to work with General Electric and build fast reactors, because the Prism was already designed. And... of course, Areva and General Electric are competitors, but there's a long history of competing companies working together. But she was very enthusiastic about the EPR and didn't want to hear about it. What are the negatives? It sounds too good to be true. That's probably the biggest negative. It works. You know, the people who developed it, I took a trip through Idaho National Laboratory with Charles Till and some of his top people who had developed the integral fast reactor. And the pride that they felt was palpable. They were convinced that they had solved humanity's energy problem. And they thought by now the entire world would be running on IFRs. But you know, it's not like it's a conspiracy or anything. It's mostly greed and short-sightedness. It's not very dramatic. It's just that politics works in strange ways, and economics also. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of fossil fuel companies that would not like to see this happen. But I never found any kind of conspiracy. Some people think that it's a conspiracy, but it's just human short-sightedness, I think. Somebody else had a microphone.
Okay, with such a bright outlook for the future, and without conspiracy, but with breaks, what's your best estimate for a schedule, a realistic schedule for massive deployment in the US first, because for non-proliferation resistance issues, I think that it should begin with the US, and then worldwide, what could be the realistic schedule, massive deployment?
When I wrote Prescription for the Planet, I had not heard about molten salt reactors. I didn't know anything about them. I very soon started learning about them. I frankly think that if the UK decides to do this, say within the next year, if the UK decides to have GE build a pair of Prism reactors, it'll probably take the UK 3 years to approve the design, and then another 3 years to build. So realistically, the fastest I think we'll see this is 6 years. There's also the question of the MOX plant that's being built by Areva and Savannah River National Laboratory, which a lot of congressmen are upset, and they would like to see PRISM reactors built there. Now, if you did that at a national laboratory, you wouldn't have to get it licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It would be an experimental project. But that's iffy. You know, it could happen. And the UK, the top nuclear person in the UK at the Department of Energy said, well, if you guys would just build it in Savannah River, then we'd build it. And I said, the people in the US are saying the same thing. If you guys would just build it, we'd build it. So it's hard, but I think 6 years the earliest. Now, molten salt, there's a lot of molten salt reactors that are being developed, and with a timeline as little as 4 years. So, and they won't take 20% enriched fuel. They'll only need like 3 or 4%. So I suspect that you'll see molten salt reactors coming online first. Now, the nice thing about the pyroprocessing system is you can not only recycle all of the light water reactor oxide fuel and the metal fuel, but you can also recycle spent fuel from molten salt reactors. So it's essentially a kind of a one-size-fits-all recycling project. And that'll help a lot, because when I talk to people that operate molten salt projects, the question always, you know, was, what are you going to do with the spent fuel? And it was always kind of like, well, we'll just store it for 10 or 20 years and figure out what to do with it later, which technically is completely sensible, politically not so sensible. So it's good that we have, we'll basically have a recycling system that'll work for that too. So I'm hoping that within 5 years we'll see at least one molten salt reactor design that's up and running, and then you'll be able to service the molten salt reactors with PRISM reactors. You could probably service about 8 to 10 molten salt reactors with one PRISM reactor, converting the spent molten salt fuel into fuel for fast reactors.
That's a question related to the safety of these reactors, because metallic fuel has a very low melting temperature. And if you have a transient room problem, you can even vaporize the metallic fuel.
Can what?
Vaporize.
Oh, yeah.
And due to the high thermal conductivity of this fuel, you may have a huge vapor explosion in case of accident. So what is the...
At Argonne Lab back in, gosh, it was just like right before the Chernobyl accident, they did a loss of heat sink and a loss of flow test, two tests where they just completely shut down the heat sink, completely shut down the pumps, and you get a temperature spike that rises really fast, and then it just shuts itself down. Just the physics of the system prevent the heat getting to the point where the fuel melts. And it's you probably saw, if you saw Pandora's Promise, they showed the test in there. Even if it melts, it's, you know, I'm not technically qualified to answer this question, but I've discussed it with Charles Till and Yun Chang, and it doesn't seem to be an issue. And they ran these things at, you know, like I say, when you shut off the heat sink, you shut off the pumps, it still works fine. It shuts itself down, and it doesn't damage the reactor. You can go in and start the reactor up again.
I will continue to work on this one.
Yeah, okay.
I have a few comments, but it is a long debate between France and US on metal fuel. And recently we had a lot of discussion on that. One, and relative to PRISM to reactor, and some comments on the fuel behavior. In fact, the US performed on EBR2 some experiments. But with uranium driver fuel. It was not a uranium-plutonium metallic fuel. It was only uranium metallic fuel. And in fact, there is a lot of open question from R&D point of view on the behavior of uranium-plutonium metallic fuel in case of high temperature. About 700 degrees Celsius, we can have some chemical degradation. We have a lot of discussion with the US colleagues on that, and it is not a clear point. What is the status of the maturity of uranium plutonium metallic fuel?
But the fuel pins that they recycled, the 30,000 fuel pins that they recycled, they put a lot of those back in the reactor, and they had plutonium in them.
Yes, but I'm speaking of the safety behavior of the fuel pin. I am speaking of the safety of the behavior under under a loss of flow or some top events of uranium plutonium metallic fuel inside the reactor. Not during the whole processing.
Well, yeah, but that's the kind of fuel they were using when they did the tests in 1989. They were using fuel that had been recycled. So it wasn't just uranium. They started out with just uranium. But once they started recycling it and putting it back in, it was a mix of actinides. And matter of fact, I've had some physicists who say, well, you know, if you're recycling this, you're going to end up with a buildup of americium and curium. You're eventually going to have to sort that out. But they thought about that too, so they fabricated some fuel pins that had a lot of americium and curium in them, and they put them into the reactor to see what would happen, and they just fissioned away, and it was fine. So I can't say that I'm technically qualified to respond to the fine points of your question, but I know that they had mixed actinide fuel in the reactor.
My comment is on the safety demonstration of the behavior of uranium plutonium metallic fuel inside the reactor. We have a lot of debate between the French approach and the US approach. These two safety demonstration approach are very different. And in fact, it is why we have not the same view in France on the metallic fuel compared to the position in the US. I am speaking on the uranium plutonium and on the prism reactor. It is very interesting design, very simplified design. But after Fukushima accident, we review the design and we have a lot of questions on some strong bypasses on the containment, because the cooling system is based on the air directly. It is a direct air system.
Mm-hmm.
It is less cost, obviously, but you can have a strong bypass in case of core degradation to the atmosphere directly.
Yeah.
And because the design is based on the fact that the likelihood of core melting is too small, then we can avoid to implement mitigation device in the design. At that point, it is a clear difference between the French safety approach.
Yeah. I know the risk assessment process is being, it's under review and it's being done again. Their probabilistic risk assessment studies early on were very, very good, but they decided that they would redo them. I don't know if that project is finished yet or not, but you keep working on Astrid and we'll see what happens with GE. But it would be nice if you just work together. And I guess you do have a lot of communication with the... Does the Astrid project get a lot of input from General Electric as well?
We have a lot of exchanges with Idaho and Arbor.
Yeah. Great.
It is an open question, and I think it could be an open question for a long time.
Okay.
Maybe I will add a small comment about the pyro process and development. To my opinion, the idea of integrated fast reactor is a fantastic idea, because it tackles the What is, I think, a problem if nuclear is growing and growing is the transportation of fuel from the processing and fabrication plants to the reactor. So this is a good answer. But if you want to be schematic, I think we don't have the proof it works. So that is my opinion. After the attempts you mentioned in the United States with very small things, and, it was experiments handmade. And it was, mm-hmm. There was a crucible to be putting this on this. And you tried, as far as I know, you tried to develop a kind of pilot plant, able to treat hundreds of kilograms. And this was in Argonne West, now Idaho. And I visited this plant. And it didn't work as expected. As far as I know, it was to process about, I think, 5 tons a day, 5 tons a year. And up to now, I think, 20 years after, only 4 tons have been processed. And that I could try to summarize in a very simple idea. My experience, I have been engaged in the development of the curettes in France. My experience is, in this field, it is a very long way from the idea to industrial operation. For intensive process, the idea and the first experiment were done in the late 40s. And we were only able to build a model of a processing plant at the beginning of the 90s. So 50 years of very heavy and huge R&D. I think in the CA in the 70s, there was hundreds and hundreds of people working on that, on a well-known process, actual process. So I think it's very difficult to compare, as you did, you tried to do, a picture of the conceptual design with a picture of a real plant. This could be rather misleading, and I think it's questionable, in my opinion.
Okay, well, I didn't have a picture of the actual plant because it hasn't been built yet, so that's the best I could do. One comment about the fact that they've recycled less fuel at Idaho National Lab than planned. You know, frankly, I think part of the reason is because they're doing it purposely slowly, because they don't want that recycling facility to be shut down. So it was kind of a slow walk thing. It was difficult to convince the government to keep it open in the first place. So they're experimenting with a lot of different fuels, but you know, it remains to be seen. Like I say, we should be able to start either build one of these or start up South Korea's pyroprocessing plant within 5 years or less, for sure. And then we'll see. And I think it's lunchtime, right?
Okay. Merci. Je crois que Jean-Paul a quelques annonces à faire que je suis incapable de faire sur ce qui se passe maintenant en termes d'organisation.
Oui, donc maintenant c'est l'heure du déjeuner. Donc, déjà, il reste quelques documents qui avaient été faits, d'ailleurs l'année dernière à l'Université d'été à Paris, qui était le poster qui avait été présenté à l'UNF, au CIFCC, dans le cadre de